Hello, I'm Gareth Mitchell. This is Somewhere on Earth, and it's Tuesday, the 30th of January, 2024. We're in London with voices from Cambridge in the UK, Belgrade, and Taiwan. And experting today is none other than Peter Guest. So hello, Peter, how are you and all that stuff?
I'm good, Gareth. How are you?
Yeah, not too bad. All right, thank you. Feeling actually quite cheerful because of this news about, there's lots of moon news at the moment. And Japan became the fifth country to land a spacecraft on the moon last week. And I wanted to give them a shout out because I think it's really cool what they've done. And this was the most precise ever moon landing, and they got to within 100 meters of the target site, which isn't bad. You know, it's kind of, you know, from quite a long way out to 100 meters of the target site. And they got there and then realized they did have problems, because moon missions generally tend to, and that's even the ones that arrive safely, which isn't by any means all of them. So they had issues with the power supply, apparently. So the craft was sleeping on the lunar surface for a week. And then through kind of maybe some magic of geophysics, but the lighting conditions on the moon changed in favor of the spacecraft. So its solar panels are now picking up sun and they can produce power again. And so they've resumed ops. And yeah, it's a bit hard to land on the moon. So I know, as if he needs to tune into a tech podcast to find out why. But are you into all this moon stuff, Peter?
I'm a very firmly lapsed physicist, but there is still a romanticism about moon landings. So the idea of hitting a moving target, it's a few meters wide from thousands of kilometers away. It's an incredible engineering feat, if nothing else.
It's not bad at all, is it? Yeah. And one thing that I should know this, but I just learned this week, one reason, you'll know this, Peter, I'm sure, why it's so hard, one of many reasons it's hard to land on the moon, is because there's no atmosphere there. So you can't just deploy a parachute like you can on Mars, which at least has some atmosphere. And I didn't know that. And maybe there are other people in podcast land who also didn't know that and will be glad that they've learned something already. If you knew it already, folks. Should we move on? You're giving me that look, Pete. Enough already.
Say, educate, inform, what is it?
And, well, entertain, allegedly. People make their own mind up about that. Okay, here comes the show. And coming up in the programme, it's all about AI today, and when you have a very powerful technology, geopolitics is never far away, and before you know it, nations and superpowers are fighting over world domination. Who knew? So, like, Europe is now regulating AI, but the European Union isn't entirely unified. Meanwhile, big nations elsewhere are just cracking on with it and barging the technology through. In contrast, though, places like Taiwan are taking a slightly different approach. They're actually asking citizens what they want for AI. Anyway, AI, what next? And what should we do with it? That's an important question. It's two questions, actually. Lots to talk about right here on the Somewhere on Earth podcast. And also to get us talking is Dr. Kerry McInerney of the University of Cambridge, and she's just co-edited a book called The Good Robot, Why Tech Needs Feminism. And Kerry's also the co-editor of the book Feminist AI. In fact, more about that book and those ideas in the Pod Extra, in the subscription version of this podcast. But first, Kerry, well, welcome, first
Thank
of all.
Thank you so much for having me.
No worries at all. And just picking up on this whole sort of geopolitics of AI, is it going too far to say that there's an AI arms race going on at the moment?
Yes, I don't know if it's necessarily fair to say there is an AI arms race right now, but that exact idea or narrative has absolutely been proliferating in a lot of news media, particularly US-based news media, which has increasingly bought into the idea that the US is locked into a power competition with other great nations, particularly China, and that AI is going to play a really central or crucial role in this power battle. And that manifests in everything from the individual components that are used to make AI-powered technologies like chips through to the concept of AI or being an AI superpower, which I think is really interesting.
Yeah, and lots of fights over the IP from the technology, and one superpower denying the other superpower access to some of the tech, and it just goes on and on. So clearly there's conflict over there, and yet at the same time, as I've hinted or maybe even said in the introduction in the menu, that governance is quite an issue, and clearly quite a range of approaches to governance in different parts of the world. So should we just start with the EU? Because it does have some regulation now behind AI, doesn't it?
Yes. You know, very excitingly, we've seen the very contested passage of the EU AI Act. And I think this is one of the most comprehensive legislation packages we've ever seen when it comes to AI-powered technologies. I think a defining feature of this act is that it categorizes technologies into different risk categories. So, for example, things like AI-powered hiring technology might be considered high risk. And so that means you need to go through an additional number of checks or particular features if you're going to use them. Which is a huge improvement to the very ad hoc way we've seen a lot of these technologies been used in the past. I do think it still raises quite a lot of questions around enforcement, what it means to effectively make sure that a high-risk technology is being used well, and also whether companies and the people who actually make these technologies understand this piece of legislation well enough and how to implement it. But at the same time, you know, I think it's still a huge step forward compared to where we were, say, 3 to 5 years ago.
Yeah, exactly. And I think, Peter, in that case, the idea of being more specific about the risk profile of AI rather than trying to throw blanket regulation at the whole technology and lumping it all into one thing, Pete.
There's going to be some nuance in the way that this is actually implemented and enforced. And you know, this is some time ago now, but as the AI Act was being put together, I remember speaking to a couple of people involved in its drafting and in lobbying around it. And one of them described it as fighting the last war, trying to sort of retrospectively look at the mistakes they made, you know, 5, 10 years ago in trying to regulate social media platforms, which is kind of the feedstock for a lot of this AI. And a lot of the harms that we see people now projecting onto AI are actually harms that began with the social media companies. Now, they've really struggled to actually enforce the rules that they put in place there. Quite often they throw fines at companies. The fines either don't get paid or they get paid and they're not particularly substantial. So enforcement for me is probably the really big challenge, more so than just drafting the law.
Yeah, exactly. Enforcement is always the issue, I suppose, with any regulation, but it just seems to be especially slippery with AI. And yet, in the meantime, you've got like China, which just seems to be cracking on with it and just, you know, barging the whole sort of technology through. But although Peter, you reacted in a kind of non-verbal way there. Is that have I mis-clarified things, or is there some nuance here, maybe?
And there's definitely. I mean, I think Carrie will probably know better than I do. But I think the interesting thing about China and AI is really who gets to develop the technology and the way that they're able to do so. So China's actually been, from what I understand, pretty strict on trying to regulate a lot of both the uses of and the ownership of AI. Obviously, it does see like a geostrategic imperative to develop this. But they're also very, very focused on controlling what people can see, how people can use the technology. So the sort of chatbots and the wild availability of AI that we've seen in the West isn't necessarily also playing out in China. So I think it's a bit more of a complicated picture than just moving ahead as they are, you know, all full speed. All right.
So there is nuance. Yeah. Thanks for picking us up on that, Peter and Kerry.
If I can jump on that really quickly, I definitely agree that there's interesting problems here to do with state censorship and then what is able to be produced, for example, by a large language model or generative AI requires a huge amount of state interference and oversight, which makes the kind of open and fast development of these technologies quite difficult. I also think that there is quite a strong narrative put forward by certain actors in Silicon Valley that China is this very unregulated landscape, that it's this very pro-innovation landscape. And that means that the US should similarly make sure that it has a pro-innovation, very lax regulatory landscape so that American companies don't, quote unquote, fall behind their Chinese counterparts. And, you know, I think that if you trace where that language is coming from, I wonder if it says a little bit less about the Chinese regulatory environment and maybe a little bit more about what some American big tech firms are hoping for when it comes to the regulatory landscape in the next few years.
Which brings us beautifully to the United States then. And we're going to hear a reporter piece in just a couple of minutes. But just to take us there, just briefly then, what is the scene in the US with Silicon Valley driving quite hard, as Silicon Valley does, to have its way and have it side of the of things? So what about America?
I think the US is one of the most interesting and complex spaces. And I say this, you know, with the huge caveat that I don't come from a law background. And so my understanding of the nitty gritty of the legalities of it might not be 100% the best. But what I will say is I think you see a real unevenness in the regulatory landscape there, where you have, in some cases, some of the most kind of strict forms of regulation on particular uses of a technology. So really strict regulations around the use of video AI hiring tools, for example. And I believe that New York also has a city ordinance on this. But then you have other technologies and other kinds of data collection practices that are really unregulated because you don't have this kind of federal wide regulatory framework. We did have, of course, Biden's recent statement or executive order on AI, which I think was a huge step forward in many ways in terms of signaling that the US is going to take these regulatory moves more seriously. But of course, you know, that does again raise this question of enforcement, which is, you know, this is not a binding order as far as I understand. And so I think that battle for regulation is going to continue.
All right. Well, folks, thanks for summing up what's going on there with some of the big powers that spring to mind. And of course, that's at the, you know, very kind of high level, the policy level. But what about in society, the people whose lives are, of course, are affected by this technology? Well, in one part of the world, they've come up with a rather novel concept. If society wants this massively powerful technology to work best for the people and quite possibly the planet, how about actually asking, well, the people? That is what Taiwan has been doing, and the outcomes have been feeding into policy. Other projects to pull together perspectives from everyday people have been emerging too. Here's reporter Shiroma Silver.
Last year, tech leaders started talking about the potential existential risks posed by AI and the need for regulation. But how would we even go about realizing these concerns that regulation needs to address? Here's Professor Brent Mittelstadt of the Oxford Internet Institute, a specialist in AI ethics and the governance of emerging technologies.
So the general hopes and fears that people have about AI are pretty diverse because it's a very diverse technology. Because of that, because it's such a broad technology, you end up with people having very different fears, very different hopes for it.
And therein lies a problem. Because it's so big, it's hard to get our heads around where to even start in terms of regulating and making sure that AI works for us.
We've seen a number of regulatory frameworks emerge in over the last year. So we have the AI Act in Europe, which is basically a product safety framework for AI. We have the executive order from the White House that was released just a couple months ago that has a number of different sort of requirements for AI around things like bias and reporting and documentation, and covers a huge range of things, but it's top down. It's meant to be a regulatory instrument.
But with the regulations just mentioned, the models are already set. And given how unfathomable AI is for most of us, starting from the grassroots to work out what it is about AI that needs governing may be a way forward. One venture that's examining more popular approaches to shaping the rules was recently launched by OpenAI and comprised 10 project ideas from around the world, one of which is called Recursive Public. Here's one of its key players, Carl Miller.
The aim of all of this is basically to try and source new democratic signals for AI governance. At the moment, there just isn't a particularly good way to kind of source all of that, map it, and feed it into the many, many, many different points of discussion and deliberation decision-making that is happening around AI at the moment, knowing what the public thinks in a more precise and clearer way.
So Recursive Public's aim was to find a consensus that captured social values to examine the issues people had with AI. It was run both in the UK and in Taiwan.
When a consensus is identified, lift it out and see whether we can turn that into something which is actually useful for decision makers, whether they sit in a large company or whether they sit somewhere else.
But the discussions would be continuous.
A recursive discussion, one that's always going to evolve, always going to change, always going to have new inputs and therefore produce new outputs around AI governance.
Central to this is a digital democratic process that was pioneered in Taiwan named V, or Virtual Taiwan, which is a way of collecting ideas and inputs from society at large. Here's Xu Yangling, who, along with Taiwan's digital minister, Audrey Tang, helped to drive V Taiwan.
V Taiwan is a community-run methodology that leverage online tools to facilitate public participation in a decision-making process to address complex issues facing the society.
To expand, it works so that anyone who decides to take part, be they from the government, from companies, or ordinary citizens, gets to draft statements on an AI-driven platform called Polis. The aim of the game is to get the highest level of consensus, not just from people who may happen to be on your side of the debate, but from across the spectrum of opposing opinions by drafting statements that get the broadest consensus. Whoever manages that wins. And VTaiwan's first real-life test was a debate in 2016 about whether or not Uber should be allowed to operate alongside conventional cabs on Taiwan's roads.
The government of Taiwan sort of started approaching the VTaiwan community and utilizing this platform to see if there could be a more diverse conversation with diverse stakeholders and gauge the opinions from the society on how do we actually regulate Uber.
The most consensual statements reveal people's biggest concerns lay around the safety of Ubers and whether they'll be charging a fair price to both the public and to other taxi services.
And in the end, we used those set of common ground statements to guide regulatory framework for ride-sharing services in Taiwan.
In other words, the statements elicited by VTaiwan set the agenda for the regulations later brought in to govern Uber in Taiwan. After this, it went on to be used to debate dozens of other issues such as Airbnb and e-scooters. And this same process was used in Recursive Public to glean early signs that could feed into any agenda to debate AI governance. Xu Yan Lin, whose idea it was to use VTaiwan's methodology in this context, felt that it was ideal to discuss a seemingly insurmountable subject.
It's a fact that when people try to discuss issues around AI, even like where do we start, how do we start discussing about it, was the issue itself.
So what were the results on the debate around AI?
People are very concerned that the benefits of AI should be fairly equally distributed. They're concerned that's not happening and that there's concentrations of the benefits of AI in important ways. There were lots of statements around AI not just benefiting human beings, and certainly not benefiting human beings at the expense of the environment or of animals. Techno-environmentalism.
There were also concerns about AI's green footprint. A big ask was that people's rights and privacy be guarded and for AI to supplement rather than replace the advancement of human beings. When it came to AI and power, people wanted to see international cooperation. But crucially, people wanted ordinary citizens like you and me, not just the experts, to be kept up to speed with the implications of AI and what it's going to mean for us all. Meanwhile, Brent Middlestadt says that governance models need to have a combination of approaches to really work.
If we're talking about the UK or the US or the European Union, we're talking about democratic societies. We're talking about societies where, you know, there are clear power structures. There are democratically legitimate institutions that have the power to make certain sorts of decisions. The risk of having just sort of bottom-up, soft law, self-assessment approaches to governance, where really companies are leading the ways, is you get this very important but also very subtle shift in decision-making power away from these sort of democratic institutions and towards companies. So that's why it's really important to not just have these sort of bottom-up models of governance, but rather to also have top-down ones to complement them so you still have the decision-making power kept within democratic institutions.
That's Shiroma Silva. So let's get reaction from Kerry and Pete here in the studio. And I was obviously quite... Well, I was surprised, Kerry, and rather delighted that there are means of, that there are even tools for gauging all the subtleties and nuances and paradoxes that come out of a load of views when you ask society what they think about a technology.
I found this a really fascinating project, and I was particularly interested in what kinds of views ended up being quite prevalent that they described. Like, for example, the concern with sustainability and making sure that the environmental impact of AI was grappled with. I don't know if I would have expected that to be the first major concern that came up, and that made me feel really encouraged because I do think this is something that has only maybe entered public consciousness in the last couple of years. So it made me feel just a little bit better about myself as an AI ethicist that maybe some of the things we say occasionally do take hold.
Oh, it's not all in vain, Kerry. There we are. So Pete, what about you? And if we talk about Taiwan that came up in that piece, a fascinating example, you know, so-called V Taiwan, where the V is a small v. I like to point these things out, even though we're a podcast. And almost like sort of gamification of finding out how society settles into some kind of consensus. You know, presumably, if you're going to gather all these thoughts from the people, you want to make it engaging at the very least.
Yeah, I mean, I'm very interested in the approach. Taiwan's been generally a really interesting case study in how to cross over technology and civil society, and like through the government and the hacker spaces and the various different architecture they've created around it. It is a much more consensual approach to managing technology. I think, returning to Kerry's point earlier about narrative, I also think what's really interesting is the discrepancy between what people actually want to see from AI and what they think is a positive outcome and a management of risk, and what Silicon Valley in general is pushing as a narrative of what the goods of AI. And if you think that a lot of the AI companies really began with utopian visions of what the future would look like, and it was a utopian vision that they had themselves defined. But when you actually measure it against what people say they want, there's a huge difference. And I find that an absolutely fascinating example of like how we can actually design technology as the consumer wants it rather than as the consumer is told they want it.
Yeah, and the idea, and this sounds very utopian, Kerry, but for the benefits of this technology to be better distributed. And it'd be hard to find anybody, certainly like a rational person, who would even say, well, it's anything other than we want this technology to be better distributed. But is it rather charmingly, naively utopian even to have conversations about better distributing the benefits of this technology?
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
AI is changing the game of business. Will you be on the winning team? I'm Jordan Wilson, the host of the Everyday AI podcast and your coach to help you learn the X's and O's of AI. Artificial intelligence isn't just a new player in the game, it's a new sport altogether. So if you don't quickly put AI into play, your competitors will run up the score. I've spent my whole life building winning teams, from coaching basketball to working with big players like Nike and Jordan Brand. My next move? Helping you win with Everyday AI. Listen wherever you get your podcasts or on everydayaipodcast.com. Let's tap into AI together and put points on the board.
I think it's a hugely important conversation, and it's really fascinating, again, that this was one of the primary ideas that came to the fore in this participatory process, because I think one of the major issues we see with the contemporary AI industry right now is this huge concentration of power in the hands of a very small number of usually US-based tech firms who are making a lot of unilateral decisions about technologies that we use in our everyday life and that it's very hard for us to opt out of. And I think what some of those answers are getting towards is this idea of, you know, technology should be made by and for the communities that are going to be using them, because those communities understand what they need and they don't need necessarily to have their particular desires shaped by external forces who might not have a good grasp of the particular context that they're in and, you know, the particular kinds of questions they might be wanting to answer.
But even if this does feed into policy where, you know, there's a consensus and society says, yeah, you know, this is all going to work better for the people, this is kind of how we're going to do it. But then where do we go from there when we're talking about some very powerful forces, commercial forces, if nothing else, perhaps driving in another way? You know, when competition gets involved, then utopia goes out of the window pretty quickly, doesn't it? And Kerry and or Pete, let's go for Kerry and then I'll put you on the spot first and then Pete after that.
Sure. I mean, I see this almost like a handshake. Like on the one hand, I see different kinds of design processes like participatory design or more experimental ways of thinking about how we make products being really exciting. And there are a lot of small firms and organizations and civil society organizations in particular who are engaging in these more participatory design processes, who are saying that, again, you know, we can actually have technologies that are meaningfully small and localized and reflective of a particular place that they're going to be used in. On the other hand, I also think this is where the regulation and governance question comes back with a vengeance, because I think one of the reasons we end up with so many products that transparently don't work for a lot of people, that are maybe exclusive or affect people particularly badly who are already vulnerable, is because big tech companies, even if there's people within them who are very well-meaning, ultimately don't have a responsibility to the public outside of the shareholder. And so, again, that's why I think you need that regulatory movement to keep them in check, because that's the only way, I think, that public interests can be protected.
And when you have good regulation, then and if it's properly applied and enforced, and one hopes that you know, that if your competitor is playing by those rules and has to, and there are big penalties if they don't, then everybody else is going to play by those rules, and that's regulation being more of a race to the top rather than to the bottom. My two penneth worth, but I promised you a right of reply on this then, Pete.
Well, firstly, I'm going to lobby for Utopia Goes Out the Window to be the new name of this podcast. But so I think firstly that there is within that report, speaking to the, again, to the point of narrative, but also to the point of regulation, the first thing that people discussed was the conversation about existential risk. And I'm really worried about the constant reframing of this discussion around existential risk. AI is going to destroy society and take us to pieces, you know, individually and collectively. Now, I think there was a bit of a distraction effect here. People who own those big AI companies spent a lot of time last year going around the world telling everyone they'd accidentally built this doomsday weapon, they needed governments to regulate it. Now, if you were a cynic, which you know, I'm never going to be, you might say that if you're a startup that doesn't have many products and you want to get in the same room as prime ministers and presidents, you tell everyone you've got a device in your pocket that could end humanity. If you're even more cynical, you might say, well, going out and making sure everyone is focused on the low probability, high risk event that may happen where in the future, you're distracting from the discussion about the things exactly we're talking about, the consensual development of AI, the real day-to-day potential harms caused by it. That reframing of the debate slightly worries me, and it does feel like the direction we're moving in.
Well, Kerry, this is of great interest to you because you've written about this. You've edited books where arguments like this are being made, that, you know, you're talking about, you know, very bad consequences for individuals. I'm thinking, like, for instance, not being shortlisted for jobs because, you know, people like you are not being reflected in the data, for instance. And, you know, and I do wonder, I think Pete's setting this up very well, whether I don't mean us in this room, but just as a society, there is a risk that we keep talking about these cataclysmic events and maybe not enough time talking about, you know, just the important but smaller things that happen at the micro level.
Yeah, exactly. And I think there's almost two parallel issues here. I think one is this question of like oxygen, or like which story or which problems are taking up the most space in the room. Like, to be incredibly clear, I'm really grateful we have people thinking about the catastrophic events. But I do often find that sometimes when you try to talk about the more day-to-day mundane events, which are extremely damaging, but maybe less dramatic, less sexy, have less of a kind of science fiction narrative to them, they can get overshadowed. And so suddenly I think this question of how do we ensure that those harms that are maybe less dramatic but are just as important are getting the necessary space and attention, I think that remains really key. And on the other hand, you know, I think we have this question of who's controlling this existential risk narrative. That's not to undermine, again, fantastic researchers who are thinking very seriously about these wide-scale risks of AI. But when we think about, say, big tech leaders who are doing a lot to propagate that narrative, I have to admit I've become a little bit skeptical of why they're putting so much energy into that story, because as the people who probably individually have the most control over which technologies are made, surely if they really profoundly believe in this existential risk narrative, they would stop making those technologies rather than doing things like, for example, lobbying for weaker AI regulation in the case of OpenAI and the EU AI Act, for example.
Right, okay. So where does that leave us as we wrap this debate up then? Are we at some kind of inflection point where, you know, we're learning how to build the technology and learning how to regulate it? Or, you know, will this be some kind of moment that people look back on and say, it was a lost opportunity to make it good. It could have gone so well and now look where we are. You know, whether people be saying that in 10, 15 years' time. Who wants to go first? Horrid question. Have to think of a way of wrapping it up somehow.
I mean, do you want my cheerful response to it?
Of course, Peter. Our cheerfulness correspondent, as you know.
I mean, I just like, as Gary mentioned, like, look at who owns it and look at the decisions they make. Stop seeing AI as being an inevitable thing that happens. It's the consequence of people's decisions and actions. We talked about arms race at the start. and we just talked about OpenAI, you know, one story that I've been looking at the last few weeks is OpenAI quietly changing its policies around military use of its technology. Now, it took Google about 10 to 15 years to take Don't Be Evil off its masthead. OpenAI has only been in business a few years, and they've already taken that strategy, quietly taken that away. That's a decision that they've made, and there will be consequences. See it as the consequences of people's decisions.
All right. Okay, Kerry.
And I think OpenAI is a really interesting example in this case as an institution that started as a nonprofit and then became commercialized. And I think that's really emblematic of where I see us being at this inflection point, which is I do think we're in this crucial period, which is really exciting, where there is increased awareness about AI ethics, about the risks of AI and how AI can entrench forms of inequality. At the same time, I think to combat that, we would need a really fundamental restructure of where power is in the AI industry, and particularly this concentration of power in the US in the hands of very few firms. So I think it would need to be really quite a fundamental, dramatic change.
All right. Utopia still a way off, I think is what we can conclude from that. Well, thank you both, Dr. Kerry McInerney of Cambridge University, and also you, Pete, as well. So there we are. But before we go, we would like to take a comment from a dear listener as well. Complete subject change here, by the way, folks. So breathe in, breathe out. Here we go. Here's a listener who has sent us a WhatsApp voice note via code 44 for the UK, 7486 329 484. So that's 44 7486 329 484. And, well, I think this is fairly self-contained. So the listener wants to talk about a particularly important element of the show.
Hi, Samoelna, it's Snežana Ćurčić. I'm calling you from Belgrade in Serbia. I regularly listen to your podcast and I really, really enjoy it. Keep up with great work. I have a question for you. It's not really a technical question. It may even sound a bit trivial. But anyway, what is the jingle of the podcast? Every time I listen to it, it sort of plays in my head all day. It's very clever and it's very contagious. All the best.
Well, nothing at all trivial about that. It's a great question there, Snežana. And so I could ramble on about, I know a little bit about how the theme tune came about. I could ramble on about it, but I think we can do much better than that. So here actually is Lee, who put it all together for us.
Hi, Snežana, and thank you for your comments about the music. We were quite lucky with this one in that Anya and Gareth had a pretty good idea of what they wanted beforehand. So initially they said they wanted something quite upbeat, and they did actually play me a few things that they liked before. So we kind of came up with this beat quite early. And we were also quite lucky in that they already had the name for the programme. So I started singing Somewhere on Earth around in my head a bit, which actually gave us a couple of the melodic ideas. And then we just wanted to make sure that it didn't sound like it came from anywhere specific on Earth. It's the program's got a global brief, so we just tried sounds which are basically samples of real instruments from different parts of the world, and then just tried to come up with a combination that worked. And I'm glad you like what you hear.
Well, we certainly do. Well, I do, definitely. There you go. No, I think everyone does, and so does Snežana. So that's Lee telling you how that theme tune came together. And I thought that's a nice point on which to end. So you'll hear a bit more of that music. After that, if you subscribe to the podcast, you will hear our podcast extra, and you can get access to that for $10 a month. And we'd love you to come and join us there. So you'll hear more from Kerry and Pete on there. But for this part of the podcast, then thanks for listening. From all of us here on the team, audio by Keziah Wenham-Kenyon and Callum Swingler. The broadcast content team here are, of course, Lanson's team Farner, production manager Liz Teary, the editors Anya Nitorovic, and I'm Gareth this week, apparently. So there you go. See you next time. Bye-bye.